So thank you for a very interesting talk. I was thinking about what you said about visualization being usually used as a justification for the legitimization of some patient in scientific practice and so on. And I was thinking whether and the whole idea behind the hierarchy of senses, whether it is a cause or consequence of a lack of a shared culture in understanding sound cues, a lack of sound culture, which kind of undermines communication, which arguably is a sort of shared culture which we have on visual culture, which allows us to use visual culture as a way to explain and legitimize sound culture. And in that regard, could data karaoke be a movement towards that establishment such as a shared and shareable sound culture?
Thank you. I would be tempted to agree with that and to say, yes, it's both a cause and a consequence, I think. As for the potential of data karaoke, I think so. I think in some ways it can. Except the one thing, I was a little bit pained to see at some point. You usually really like when people take note of your work, right? It doesn't happen that often in academia. But at some point, the article that I wrote about data karaoke got, I forget now what it was exactly, but basically some website picked up on it in a way of sort of like, oh, look at how ridiculous this is. And they were not making fun of me for saying, oh, this is, you know, she wrote this article on such a pointless thing, but rather it was more like ridiculing, oh, there are these people standing up there on stage and they are singing back their sounds. And I felt bad about that because in a way I was opening up people to a form of ridicule that hopefully they never heard about us. But I don't know, because that was certainly not my intention, because I thought, yes, this is a really effective way of communicating, but at the same time, of course, if you're doing things like that and you're standing up on a stage at a conference where it is, of course, it's very much accepted, right, that I'm using my voice to talk about my research, but it is not, there is no kind of convention that says also use it to sing your data. So in a way, it also makes oneself vulnerable, I suppose. So in that sense, I think it has that potential, but I do not think it has that guarantee, if that makes any sense. That was bringing it down to the slightly more practical level again as well. But I think in principle, I would say, yes, it has a lot of potential to kind of draw different things together and to overcome some limitations. But at the same time, it's an ongoing project, I think. And I mean, this struggle for legitimacy, for sonification, and more generally for the idea of using more senses than are usually. I think it's not necessarily using more senses, right? Because I think from the sounds of it in this room, we can probably reach relatively widespread agreement that scientific practice does involve a lot of our senses, but acknowledging the role that it plays and going up there and saying, okay, I'm using my own voice now in such a way, that is a very strong form of acknowledging the sensory component of scientific practice, and I think it's something that is open to negotiation still. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Thank you.
First of all,
thank you for your very interesting conference. I have several questions, especially about the role of sound science in the public sphere and the struggle of this epistemological the role of this epistemological struggle behind the scientific sphere more. I have decided to do another question, much more brief, that is, what about blind scientists? And do they have something to say about sonification? Something to, they are able or urged to make a different science, and I'm thinking in scientists born blind or scientists or people who became progressively or immediately blind in a moment in their career, and I would like to this question is in depth to the members of the Judo Total Club, my former Judo Club, whose members, most of them, the members of this club are blind people, most of them, and some of them are scientists or students of science in the University of Lisbon. Mm-hmm. And this made me think about this.
Thank you very much. I'd be curious to hear from them whether they have had any engagement with sonification. But to answer your question in terms of what the role of that is within the sort of sonification practices and community, yes, that is very much part of it. There are a number of sonifications that are developed specifically with the idea in mind that they should be useful for blind and visually impaired users. There are a number of blind scientists working on developing sonifications. The most recent before that president of this international community for auditory display is a computer scientist who is was born blind himself. So for him that was clearly one of the things that drew him to sonification, and a number of other projects try to develop sonification specifically with that idea in mind. But there's also a but here, which is that it becomes, right, I was talking about how they try to legitimize listening as a kind of practice, as a method, and try to establish that as something that can be objective. The use of sonification for blind people is almost too easy a case where that is concerned. Like, nobody would say, oh yeah, no, I mean, if you have something like, for instance, graphs that are represented by pitch, it makes perfect sense that, yes, of course, someone who cannot look at the graph, listening to it is the next best thing. So in that sense, it's done a lot, and for many people, it's also the idea of being able to help someone, because there's still a lot of inequalities in terms of access to the labor market, for instance, for visually impaired people. So it can often be a strong personal motivational factor. But at the same time, for many people within the community, they are very worried about limiting the idea of sonification to that and basically positioning it as just what is called an assistive technology. Because that would suggest that it's only useful for people who are blind, and then there's no need to develop it any further. So there is that tension that they emphasize this, but at the same time they don't want it to be reduced to what its use might be for blind and visually impaired people. And there's the other fact that often when it comes to designing a specific sonification, there can be some practical tension between whether you're designing it for someone who is blind or someone who is not. For someone who is not, it's often about complementing, and so you would be trying to develop the sonification in such a way that is especially good at the things that vision is not so good. If you're developing a sonification specifically for someone who is blind, then of course you want to develop it in such a way that it does exactly the things that vision is very good at, but that a blind person has no access to. So what a lot of sonification practitioners are trying to do is to develop sonifications that are interactive, that allow to switch between. You could think of the kind of typologies I had up there also in terms of switching between users who can also see and those who cannot see. But at the same time, they certainly do not want to reduce its use case just to people who cannot see and therefore need to listen. But thanks a lot for this question.
Thank you as well. I think first of all, to just comment on one of the striking elements concerning our knowledge from sound. You mentioned, of course, the Geiger, mm-hmm. but we do have the sound of the Sputnik. Mm-hmm. And was the first time that we were outside our planet, and it was, I think, by sound and not visually. Mm-hmm. Before the moon landing, in fact, we learned about being outside the Earth,
yeah,
by sound, and that was very interesting. But my question is more in the historical side. Normally, we think about this rule of war coming mostly through the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, and then throughout the 19th century. But lately, I was thinking about this question, and I was thinking if we couldn't we push back a little bit this idea, and going to, I would say, late Middle Ages, beginning of the Renaissance period, not in the conventional way, by thinking about the Gutenberg press as a kind of a term for the visual, but precisely in the other way around, that is the fact that this term for the visual is also something that has to do with the less power of workshop culture. And in fact, when you mentioned the case of our colleague from the history of technology, going back to the cars, and thinking about the garage, and how the car is evaluated in its health through sounds. In fact, the garage is one of the last places where workshop culture is still very relevant. And so I was wondering if we could pick up this idea of the workshop as kind of more epistemological dichotomy between using the sound, as it came from the Middle Ages, to evaluate the weather or to evaluate the dangers in the wilderness by the howling of the wolves and the sound of the wind, for instance, and then think about more kind of distance between precisely the workshop culture that begins to disappear as you don't need someone to teach you how to use a machine, you can just read it and see it from the drawings, the technical drawing. In a kind of confrontation with more academic literacy driven culture. Could we use the car of the 20th century and think back to this kind of dichotomy, which would seem to be interesting?
I think that would be very interesting. Yeah, that was outside the scope of what we're doing here.
Yeah.
But in part because we started even the more historical projects in the 1920s. But I think that's a very interesting idea for sure. And I had some more elaborate answer than that has just escaped me. I wanted to say that there is some work on the history of acoustics that I think in some ways kind of links up to that, on the way that acoustics was originally, or the idea of understanding sound used to be very much about in a kind of more workshop-like setting as well. I mean, different from these, of course, but it was very much working with musical instruments, experimenting with them, and there is some work for sure on the way that kind of musical instruments, that the role that they played in the making of knowledge about sound, and how that was also gradually pushed back. And I think that could be something of a connecting piece, perhaps, between what I was talking about in relation to the car mechanics and what you're talking about with workshop culture more generally. It wasn't what we were doing in the Sonic Skills project, but I think that would be a very, very interesting follow-up, for sure. Thank you for that remark.
John, sorry, this is tricky. I have a question about codes.
Codes?
Sound. Representation codes, because of the connection with the visuality. I was thinking about the work of, for instance, Edward Tufte in the field of visual representation, and how, you know, in the past 10, 20 years there's been this movement with infographics, which also is also connected with the history of science and a new look on history of visual representation. And you mentioned the fact that some of these codes are very recent, some of these conventions. So I was thinking, do you see the emergence of new codes for the certification we because I'm interested in the connection between the listening and sound design. So with Ivo, we discussed, for instance, the going to go back to the car, the design of the engine, the sound of the engines of the car.
Electric cars
in particular. So this has a functional side, but also an aesthetic side, trying to get a better sound, even if it's not by analogy, right? I'm not sure if I'm right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sorry, I was regretting that I hadn't this away already. Because I thought this was something that I sort of glanced over a little bit. This went out anyway. Never mind. it's a very, very good point, for sure, and I think I didn't really say enough about it. But it should have been part of the talking where that was entitled Following the Eye, so how sonification that you were referring to earlier as well, how sonification links up to visualization in trying to establish its relevance and objectivity. And as part of that, there is very much reference also to the fact that visualization has reached some codification and that sonification should do the same. I've definitely seen some references specifically to Tüpte as well. But also there was that, what I wanted to go back to is that I had that long quote on the slide at some point where the sonification people were also referring to stethoscopes and car engines, and as a sort of aside in there, we're saying we need to train our ears more, and then kind of almost in brackets was, and some standardized and informative techniques to hear data. So this idea that more codification, more standardization is necessary in order to be able to sort of establish sonification as a kind of more standard way of dealing with data is very much part of that discourse as well, and something that they are trying to do both in terms of the terminology for different kinds of sonifications, but also in terms of having some kind of conventions for how to represent certain kinds of sound. However, there is little agreement on what these conventions should be.
Before I go to the next question, but even to try to establish the convention, even the idea that they should establish a convention, it's very contested, right? Because I'm thinking about the words by Stefan Baras, who really contests this, if you can approach this.
Yes, but I think in a way it takes so this is someone who's really arguing for a more design-like rather than science-like approach to who you're referring to doing sonification. So that is true. There is contestation even about the idea that there should be a standardization. I would think I could be misrepresenting him here, but I would think that even people like that still think that there should be something like design principles that can be reused, and that there should be more learning from best practices, not necessarily perhaps strict conventions and standardizations. But at least articulating why something worked well in one context and what of that might be able to travel into a different context, what might even be able to work the same way across contexts, what adaptations are necessary. So the idea of kind of creating possibilities for something that worked well in one context to travel somewhere else, I think is not so contested, but indeed the extent to which that should be sort of formalized and standardized is contested, and what is even more contested then is what exactly sort of like, you know, what should be the things that need to be standardized. So yes, it's true, it's contested for sure within the community. It's a very interdisciplinary community with very different kinds of inputs.
You mentioned this talk. I'm just so curious about the karaoke.
I'm really very grateful that we didn't organize the karaoke. Yeah. We should have done a small half an hour of the karaoke.
Maybe the bow and arrow you can try to create.
previous vocal training, either as singers or as actors? Or do they just spontaneously go? And also, maybe related to that, where are they from? Is there, like, in terms of countries, is there a place where it's practiced more, or people from there practice more? And the second part of the question is, this is maybe a bit silly, but do you know if there is any kind of precedent of using vocal synthesizers for data karaoke, like the Vocaloids?
Sorry?
The Vocaloids. Or if there is any kind of use of data karaoke in artistic practices also, so two parts.
Yeah, that's an interesting set of questions. In terms of, oh yeah, so you asked about vocal training, you asked about nationalities, and then about, yes. So in terms of the vocal training, I am not sure, but I mean, it's a small community. I am going back in 2 months, so I can try to observe a little bit more, because I haven't been to their conferences. Basically, once my PhD project was finished, it seemed harder to justify why I had to go.
Because I would never think of going on the stage.
I think they're generally people who have some affinity with some form of musical practice, but I'm not sure that they're necessarily trained as singers or actors.
Maybe formally, like in the faculties, or like when they go to college or something, or like in high school, or
I don't know. I can try to pay more attention when I go back, because for now I'm not so sure. It's something I've observed a few times, and also the first time you observe it, you don't really yet think of this as something you're gonna be looking into much more depth.
I'm actually thinking about your paper, where you discuss, for instance, what a Brazilian researcher says, that he says that having a musical background actually helps, or it can be really hindering, because then you're too conventional in your ways of thinking music.
Yes,
but
that's definitely a thing where also they say some kinds of musical background are more helpful than others, like, so there's a lot of interplay with more like experimental computer music, which has a very broad conception of what music is. There are certainly a lot of people who have some kind of musical background in the community, for sure. I think that's what, for many of them, draws them to it, even if they're not current active practitioners, but some of them are as well. But in terms of countries, I'm also not sure. It's quite a sort of international community, and there's a few sort of centers of action, but also some mobility across borders as well. It's relatively closely knit, so I think it's more within the international community that these kind of practices travel, within the conferences as well, rather than necessarily in the kind of places that they are from. Because many of them are the one person doing computation in their institution, or the one person and their PhD student, or something like that. About the vocal synthesizers, I am not entirely sure. I think it's an interesting idea. No, but I mean, it's precisely the sort of thing you'd imagine to happen in a community like that.
That's sort of for people who are not comfortable with their own voices.
Yeah,
they would still be able to do it if they have the vocal synthesizer.
The example of the sonification I played in was, of course, very much already with that idea in mind, and I think it was built upon something like that, but the idea was still that the person would then be impersonating it. But it's designed in such a way to make it easy and inviting for them to do so. But I haven't come across anyone sort of...
So one last question, really fast, from Blue.
Okay. Thank you so much, Alexander, for your presentation. It's a short question, and maybe you don't have time to answer, because you only mentioned this very briefly in your presentation, and it basically has to do with this idea of using tonification in sound art or in music. And one of the things that it got me thinking is this would it be fair to say that sonification participates also, and to paraphrase Georgina Born, in increasing rationalization of music development and research, particularly in an institutional setting, meaning trying to use the aura of scientific rigor in musical creation? Because I think this is one of the things that it's not, or it wasn't your topic of research, but this is something that I've noticed in the literature, is trying to use data in order to make music and use science as a way to justify the music making. Is it something that you feel is fair to assume? It's one of the dangers also of thinking about sonification.
Yeah. I think that links up to what Ivo was referring to earlier, actually, that this is one of the things that is also to some extent contested within the community, because people have different aesthetic kinds of visions and different ideas on whether aesthetic visions are necessary to be able to do sonification, and certainly different ideas also on what it does to musical practices when you, because some sonifications, some sonifications have a specific sort of musical aim and some do not, but also to someone interested in certain kinds of music, some will sound aesthetic and some not, and they're not always the same. It's not always the ones that have a sort of musical ambitions that will then be regarded as being sort of aesthetically interesting, because a lot of sonifications that work with the idea of, oh, let's make some music out of it, are often aesthetically quite simple. So yeah, there's a very, very complex sort of negotiations going on of what should and shouldn't be done, both in relation to what it does to the practice of sonification, and also in relation to what it does to the practice of science and of things like computer music, for instance. But yeah, that's a very interesting question for sure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, all of you.